is going to be the story, It Won't Get Any Worse, Mark H. From Pennsylvania will be, I think he's from Pennsylvania.
Homegrown U.S.
citizen. Will be reading the story, and then George R. Will be speaking afterwards. Mark will be introducing him after we're done with the story.
I'm not sure, but if she didn't say this, but what I understand is that she's got about 10 years.
Hey, Mark.
You ready for me?
Yeah. Do you have something going on in the background there?
Yeah, I'm turning it off. It's an international speaker jam with someone I know from Sweden just spoke, so he just finished. It's perfect timing. And I actually have the story here in the third edition. I can read it right from the book.
Great.
You ready for me to start?
We're ready.
I'm Mark. I'm an addict. It won't get any worse. There were a lot of reasons why I first started using. I felt different from my peers. I went to a private school. The kids in the private school didn't like me because I hung around with kids on my street who went to public school. I was a misfit. The public school kids would pick me up, would pick on me too. I couldn't leave the block, so I had to hang around with them. I grew up feeling different. I had a lot of fights with my parents because I felt very restricted. I really didn't like myself and wanted to change so that the other kids would think I was cool. I was afraid of girls and thought they wouldn't like me. My first encounter with using was when I was about 12 or 13 with a bunch of girls who were huffing glue. They were real friendly to me and asked me to join them. I didn't even have to think about it. I just did it. Huffing became very compulsive with me. I started doing it all the time, by myself and anywhere I wanted. I remember feeling guilty, thinking God's watching me, and feeling wrong. All the guys on the block could drink on the weekends, and I wanted to be a part of it, so I wanted to drink. I had to be in when it got dark, so I had to wait until my parents went somewhere on a Saturday. I wanted to be able to say that I got drunk, so I stole a fifth of booze from my father and drank the whole thing. I got really sick and did a lot of weird things in my neighborhood, and everyone knew that I was drunk. I couldn't wait until I got to school the next day to see what all the kids would say. I didn't care that they thought I was a fool. I just felt really good to know that they were all talking about me. It enabled me to say things that I was afraid to, do whatever I wanted to, and could say, well, I couldn't help it. I was drunk. Soon after, I started smoking dope and loved it. I also remember the paranoia, thinking that God was going to strike me dead. I started smoking compulsively soon after I tried it. Dope made me feel really hip and like I had a lot of friends. I remember feeling that God was a bull and that I didn't need him. All I needed was to get high, do nothing. I was just going to ninth grade and my grades were going downhill. I was fighting with my parents all the time and I was unhappy at home. All I wanted was for people to leave me alone and just let me get high. I started burglarizing houses to get booze and money to get high. Although I made $80 a week and had $700 in the bank, I was draining that quickly. I got caught ripping off houses and my parents couldn't believe it. I got put on probation and felt like it was a big joke. While I was on probation, dope was dry. So I bought 3 pints a day. I needed to get high and tried THC. I was told it was from pot. I remember hating it. As soon as I came down and was able to stand up, I wanted more. This became my drug of choice. I soon found that it was PCP, but it was too late and I didn't care. I was soon doing acid and everything else I could get. And I remember stealing medicine from my mother and doing it in school and being sent to the hospital because I could not wake up. They were downs and I took too much. I thought I just have to take less the next time. I started seeing a psychologist because my parents didn't know what to do. I told the shrink that I was just used socially. I had it together in my head. He stuck up for me and told my parents not to put it down until they've tried it. He gave me a new license to use. He helped me to get my parents off my back. My father knew I was dealing dope and was going to put me away. So I partied it up and overdosed. I told my parents that I wouldn't use like that if they weren't threatening me like that. My shrink still stuck up for me. I conned that guy into thinking I was his friend and I really cared for him. It was me and him against my parents. We convinced them that I was responsible because I paid off all my drinking fines and disorderly conducts. I usually owed money on three of them, and I was just one step ahead of the constables. I was always ripping houses off and people, other addicts. I stole money from my mother twice a week, usually $20 at a shot. Things kept getting worse for me. I had a girlfriend who did not show up for a party with me, so I did her share of the drugs as well, and mine that night. I overdosed 5 minutes after taking it. My brother found me chasing cars and barking at them, and he dragged me home, and my parents took me to the hospital. I woke up in a straitjacket that was tied to a bed that was soaked in piss and sweat. I was 15 years old then. I remember a psychiatrist asking me why I wanted to kill myself, and I couldn't understand what he was saying. I just wanted to get high. After this, I saw a shrink for a week, and he convinced me that if I took acid or PCP again, I would lose my mind. When I was in the hospital, part of me died. I was pale and slow, talking and thinking. I was physically, mentally, and emotionally beat. I tried at this point to just drink there three beers a day and just smoke one joint. I really tried, but it only lasted 3 days. I dropped and smoked as much as I wanted. I didn't use chemicals for a while. The progression was tamed for a time being. When I graduated from this shrink, he told me I could function in society if I stayed off the hard drugs. After a couple weeks, I was with a girl who had some pot sprinkled with PCP. After I smoked it, I wanted to do more. 2 days later, I was out doing anything I could to get my hands on. My master plan was being formed. I had just turned 17 and I was planning to set up this big dealing operation. I started getting paranoid, afraid of being busted or killed. I was afraid to go out in the daytime or to talk to anyone on the phone. I had to quit school and I wasn't working. I knew it was the drugs and I figured I would just stop using and clean up my act so I could use again. When I stopped using, the walls started breathing, flashes of light, sirens, friends plotting to kill me, shake, sweating, crying, and I felt like I was losing my mind. God, how I hurt. I paid friends not to kill me. They told me I was crazy and I offered them more dope. I didn't know what was real and what wasn't. In the last desperate effort to find the answer in drugs, I bought $5 worth of pot and smoked it to get to sleep for a day or two. I was halfway done smoking when I realized that I wasn't getting tired. I was getting more spaced out. It made all the things I was feeling worse, and I took the pot and pipe and threw it as far as I could. I ran home and begged for help from my father. I had never heard of a rehab before. I'd only heard of methadone program, and I wasn't a junkie. They wanted me to join an inpatient, and I wouldn't buy it. They asked if I wanted to go into an outpatient rehab, and I was willing to try it. I just wanted to stop hurting, and an addict told me that I might not get better, meaning that the walls breathing, flashes of light, shakes, sweating might never stop. If I did not use today, they wouldn't get any worse. I went for 40 days, and one morning I got up and it was all gone. The pain, the hallucinations, the paranoia. I had prayed so hard for God to remove these, and he did. That was all I really needed God for. When I felt better, I stopped praying. I attended a few meetings and really felt I didn't need them. The steps mentioned God, and I had nothing to do with that. I got better, and I tried to be a very honest person. I had a hard time staying clean. It was a constant battle. My old friends hung in front of my neighbor's house all the time. I turned down drugs a lot. My brother and I shared a room together, and he was still using. He stashed dope in the room, and I knew where it was. I used a lot of people for support and started recovering. I was always being told by my brother that my friend said hi, and the fact that I couldn't really be rid of them made it really hard. I stayed in touch with people constantly, and things at home got some better. Trust gradually developed. After going through the rehab, I had a lot of clean friends. I had a girlfriend who I moved in with. So much had been going really good. I had a diploma, a brand new car, a driver's license, and a good relationship with my parents. My girlfriend was seeing a therapist who told her she should get involved in something together, like starting an NA meeting in the area. The closest NA meeting was over an hour away, and there were only two a month at that. After we started the meeting, she got high and moved out. My best friend had been getting high for a while, and they started going out together. And that really ripped me up inside. I had a dog who cried every night, and he couldn't even stand it and ran away. My girlfriend moved out of the apartment, and I felt like nothing. Two friends I had left were still friends of hers and spent a lot of time with her. I was lonely, isolated, depressed, and I needed help. Since I started this NA meeting, I continued to go and the meeting grew. Here I was with 2 years crying in a meeting, feeling sorry for myself, depressed, and having newcomers with 30 days clean telling me it would get better. Be grateful for what you have and keep coming back. People who were new in the fellowship would come over to my house and 12-step me. They kept me coming back. They told me that they loved me. I was depressed for 2 months like that. And during that time, two more meetings started. I was making 3 meetings a week and started working the steps. I was getting involved in our area service and started being grateful for everything I had. I was so grateful to be alive and believed that it was because of the NA fellowship. It was time for me to get up off my butt and start doing something for others. I started doing public information work in my area and started accepting God's will for me. I attended a lot of meetings and spoke very often, trying to carry the message of recovery through NA. I tried giving away what I had to other persons, especially the newcomers. I prayed very often that hollow feeling of being different didn't apply anymore. I attended conventions and conferences. At one of these, I had a spiritual awakening. I saw a tiny glimpse of God's will for me, and I prayed for the courage to carry that out. Through service, I can make it possible for many addicts who seek recovery to find it in NA. Today in meetings, I try to carry a message of hope, and I let everyone know that if they want to recover from addiction, they can through Narcotics Anonymous. At one point, I realized I needed more than meetings. I heard people being told to get a sponsor and to work steps, but this was two new people. I tried to work the steps, but I really didn't know how. I didn't have a sponsor, and I wasn't sure if I needed one. Finally, I came to the point where I was ready for total surrender. That meant the things that were good for newcomers, sponsor, meeting, steps, would be good for me. I finally asked someone, and he said he would sponsor me, and I started and couldn't come out with the words, but he said, okay. We moved away from each other 2 months later, and I had to ask someone else, and I did. It's been working out real good. He guides me through the steps and helps me to think of myself. The aimless wandering I had done all my life has finally subsided. I learned to enjoy living a day at a time. I try to enjoy my struggle through the steps. I used to think that when I got to the end of the road, I would be happy. But today, I learned to experience the road I'm walking on, not being self-obsessed with where I want to be. I'm happy where I am today, and I feel I'm making progress in life. Today, I work the steps with the guidance of my sponsor, and I attend 3 or 4 meetings every week. I attend meetings to share my experience, strength, and hope. Other members learn from me in this way, and I learn from them when they share. It is important for me to always remain teachable. I pray every day and thank God for each day and the 12 steps and the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous.
Thanks for reading, Mark.
Okay.
This is where you introduce somebody.
Hey, hold on. Let me turn my volume up. I'm introducing George.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. First of all, I'm Mark, and I'm an addict. I don't know if I even said that in the beginning.
Hey, Mark.
But, I cannot tell you the honor it is that George even asked me to read that story. George is one of the people in my life that I respect and love more than most. And, you know, I've heard him share that story, you know, and then just all the things. And if the person that George is today, because of Narcotics Anonymous, I always share that don't look at the people in NA, look at the NA in the people. And anyone that has worked these steps and lived these steps is a person of integrity. And George is the biggest, biggest example of that. You know, George has a lot of time and he comes to meetings and there's all newcomers and half the kids are on their phone and this and that. And George is on his phone too. But George is reading every reading along at every meeting he goes to on his phone. And, you know, I love his home group and I'm just so honored, you know, to be able to be here and to listen what George has to say. I wish we had about 3 hours because he has like an amazing story of then and then being involved with the basic text and then his life after that. And hopefully he'll get to some of it. But George, I love you. And thanks so much for asking me. It means the world.
Thanks, Mark. I love you. I'm George. I'm an addict.
Hey, George.
Everybody. That was pretty emotional for me. I don't think I've ever had anybody read my story to me, or I don't know, maybe I did, but it really struck me very emotional today. And, you know, actually a lot of times when I read my story, I want to change, there's a couple things in there that aren't, 100% correct, but, I was lonely in early recovery. I mean, just, I had no idea. I thought that, my understanding was that drugs were the problem. I took drugs out, but there was, all the voices were still going and the chaos in my life and actually, I remember my first sponsor that I actually started going through the steps with, he started pointing out all the insanity in my life in recovery and all the unmanageability. And, I remember like the reason why I got him as a sponsor is because I watched other people who came in after me were just as bad as I was, started working the steps. And they started, how we blossom and we change and we become that spiritual person that we were meant to be. And I was hoping that, maybe that would work for me too. I wasn't sure, because we didn't have a lot of experience but I saw enough people, so I remember him pointing this out and I was feeling like I still had that thought that, well, I stopped using drugs, so I don't have any problems. And I remember saying to him, looking at all this stuff doesn't make me feel good about me. And I said, all these other guys got sponsors and they feel real good about themselves. I said, what's up with that? And he told me it was clear as day. He said, you're looking at a miracle recovery over time. He says, you're looking at a miracle like this big over, he says, how long they've had sponsors? A year and a half? He goes, okay, so a year and a half they've been working on it. You've been working on it, how last week you asked me to sponsor you? Okay, and he says, as you continue to work this process, your miracle will grow too. He says, but it's very slow. It's so slow you won't even see it. And he says, but, at some point in time, your miracle will be this big too. He said, but we have to identify the trash before we take it out. And I wasn't really sure because none of those guys ever told me about that stuff. I looked and they looked peaceful and that's all. I wanted to cop the peaceful stuff without the work, I want to talk a little bit about the loneliness because in the story, that's what it moves me. So when I got clean, there wasn't tons of people getting clean around me and they wanted to put me in a 2-year inpatient institution But I was super paranoid, and they wouldn't tell me when I was getting out. And I thought they'd lock the door, you know, behind me, and I'd never get out. So I did an outpatient, which nobody recommended. But they said, you know, if I, once I used, I could come to inpatient, you know, like, and I never picked up. But yeah, all my old friends hung out at my next door neighbor's house. Like when I come home from a meeting or from group, there were cars parked on both sides of the street. The guys leaning against the car, smoking, you know, cigarettes, joints, beer in this hand. And my car would drive right in between. They'd be on both sides of the street. They'd all wave to me. You know, I kind of felt like to get home, I had to drive through the gauntlet, you know, hey, George, hey, you know, and then I get into my house and the room that I shared, you know, was with my brother who used, and he stashed stuff in there, you know? So I got a bright idea. I grabbed this stuff and I flushed it. That didn't go over real well with him, but I guarantee you, I never found anything else in the room again. And then, oh, here's something I got to pick, you know. So we had a battle between recovery and using. And when me and him used together, like, you know, we had the Good Humor picture, the Easy Rider poster, you know, like all, you know, Good Humor with pot coming out of it, you know, like, so there, so like, I felt like I was living in like a drug den. So, so as I started going to different meetings, if I saw little slogans or something, I'd ask him if I could have that. And so eventually the room became this half of the room, like, and we went right down the center of the ceiling. So this half of the room was all recovery posters. And this other half of the room was all getting high stuff, you know, pretty wild stuff, man. But, you know, that's, but anyway, I later looked at it and it became, I learned how to deal with somebody confront me with drugs immediately. So it just became like my body reflex was if somebody offered me, I was already in the motion of walking the other way and getting out of Dodge because that's what I did at home, you know? So I looked at it as actually a benefit in helping me stay clean. But the other part that I wanted to talk about is, you know, about 2 years clean, my whole world was my girlfriend, my living girlfriend, my best friend, my two other friends. We hung out really tight together. And that was my support group. And my best friend had relapsed and so had my girlfriend, but I didn't know it. The two of them were hooking up behind my back and the other two knew about it. And so like overnight, I went to like having what I thought was a strong support group to like, I'm like, and this went on for months, like a couple months before, you know, like I found out and I felt really, really lonely. And that meeting that we had started together, you know, a couple of times I sat at the meeting, you know, hoping that people showed up. And eventually I went to a rehab and the inpatient that I was supposed to go into, since I was alumni from the outpatient, they had a meeting there once a week. So I was allowed to go to that. And somebody asked me to take them to an AA meeting. I said, can you go to an NA meeting? They said, as long as it's on the meeting list. So every week I would stop by the inpatient. I had a little Chevy Monza and I would get six people from there. It would be seven of us in this little Chevy Monza. People would be sitting on each other's laps and I'd have seven people at my meeting. Okay. And the thing was, is that when I dropped them off, like, you know, I just prayed that they came back. Like, you know, like it was lonely. Like, how come I'm the only guy that's recovering here? There had to be somebody else that, you know, like I can't be the only person with a problem with, you know, using drugs. Like everybody I know uses them. Like, how come there's like, why am I the only guy here? You know, and eventually they did a couple, you know, in the story talks about where a couple other meetings started and we were all really tight. Like we did everything together. You know, it was, you know, I was so desperate for the newcomers to stay that I felt like, you know, like as they were leaving, like I was clinging on to them and they couldn't get out the door fast enough. And I watched the other people and they were real smooth with talking to them. I felt inadequate, you know? So when the basic text came around, that's one of the tools that I looked at, you know, that like, if I had a book I could hand to somebody and say, read this, you know, like that would be a really great tool to, you know, helping people stay clean, you know. So I guess, you know, it's talking about, you know, the theme of this was that was then, this is now. So I want to tell you who I am now. And I've been through, I got clean at the age of 17. My clean date's February 27th, 1977. Okay. I'm 60 years old. I've been clean for 43 years. I had a, you know, like I kind of grew up and became an adult in Narcotics Anonymous. I had a career in construction with my father as a single guy. We wound up losing the business. I wound up getting married, having kids, and then I wound up being a stay-at-home dad. I was also a realtor and appraiser for about 10 years. So I really had, I've done a lot of different things, you know, since I got clean. And I haven't always been, a good standing member of Narcotics Anonymous. Actually, they asked me to upgrade my story for the sixth edition. But when they called me, I don't know how much time I got. I know I got a half hour, but anyway, my story wasn't in the first edition and it didn't get in there because I didn't want to write my story, because Greg Pierce had told me that if I wrote it, people may see me as a representative of Narcotics Anonymous. And I was like, I'm not a representative of Narcotics Anonymous. Like, I was 20 years old. Like, you know, what do you mean? I'm going to, you know, people are going to look at me as the recovery, you know. But when we, in our area, we did the story part of the basic text. We had this story conference in Ivyland, Pennsylvania. It probably shows up as Philadelphia in the history records. But anyway, Bo had asked me to write it. And he said, so, you know, and I told him why I didn't want to. And he said, so when there's another 17-year-old kid that's looking for identification in our book, you know, they're not going to be able to find it because you don't want to stand up and, you know, and I'm fine, I'll write it. And it, you know, wasn't like, but I understood that I needed to do it, you know, but that's why I was afraid to write it, because I didn't want to, you know, but it didn't come out because when I wrote it there, I didn't name the story and they didn't match up the release forms with the story and it came out in either the second or third edition. I'm not really sure. But I had a resentment against the basic text for that for a while. And then when the basic text came out, you better believe everybody I knew. So everybody in my area knew whose stories were in the basic text. We worked on that part. So they knew my story was supposed to be in there, and my phone would ring and ring and ring, and it would just be like, you know, like I'd have to explain that I don't know why it's not in there. I didn't find that out till years later why it wasn't in there, and I was really angry about it. I had all kinds of reasons up here why it wasn't, you know. So I guess I want to talk about how I live today, okay? I've been a stay-at-home dad for 15 years now. All right. And this to me is beyond your wildest dreams. You know, when I first got clean, my story's named It Won't Get Any Worse, because that's why I got clean, is my last time using was smoking pot and the hallucinations got worse. And nobody promised me that they would go away, but they promised me if I didn't pick up, they wouldn't get worse. And that, you know, could I hang in there just for today? And I said, I can today, but I don't know about tomorrow. And I said, well, you don't have tomorrow. Tomorrow comes and you can't deal with it, you know, give us a call, you know. And so literally my first 40 days were just hanging in there, knowing that if I don't pick up, it won't get worse, you know. And because I've hallucinated full 24/7, you know, my first 40 days clean. I got lost on why I went there. I'm a stay-at-home dad. I've been a stay-at-home dad for 15 years. When I first got in, I just wanted the hallucinations to go away. That's how I got there. That's, you know, I didn't know anything about life. You know, really, I thought if I stopped using, that life would just happen and it would be wonderful. And it wasn't until I got involved in the step process and started praying, developed a relationship with the God of my understanding, that, you know, like I felt like I had a roadmap to live. And I got angry with my parents. How come they didn't teach me how to live? Like, you know, I probably wasn't a good candidate for listening, even if they knew any better than I did. But, you know, like they did the best they could. And like when I listened to that story, my God, I think of my parents and, you know, like I'm just so fortunate. I have three kids, you know, but anyway, yeah. You know, I've been married 26 years. December next month will be 27. And we have three kids. We have one special needs kid. My twin boys are 22. They're identical twins. I have a daughter that's 24. My daughter's in Iowa doing her PhD. My other son's living still in Pennsylvania. We're down in Fort Lauderdale now. But he's in Pennsylvania and he's doing IT work. And then, you know, I have my special needs son who has autism. He's nonverbal. His autism is nonspecific. He's nonverbal. He has mental retardation and he has epilepsy. And me and him are like this, you know. If I pick up my car keys, he starts putting on his shoes. Okay. He doesn't need to know where we're going, you know. To me, that's unconditional love. You know, as long as we're hanging out together, he knows life's going to be good, and that's all that he cares for. And I remember, you know, like I said, I didn't always work a program. You know, I had lapses. And when he was born, first few years of his life, me and my wife were both probably working 60 hours a week, and we had daycare. Had somebody did our laundry. I had the lawn guy. It was just like we were like just going full speed, and then he started having issues. And when we got the diagnosis, one of the things that, you know, like I said, I wasn't working a program. I got angry with God. Why would God do this to me? Okay, out of all the things that I did. How wonderful I've been, it's funny. My sponsor today, he said, oh, so I guess because he's my third child. Okay. So, my sponsor said, so I guess the first two perfect kids that you had, you were so grateful and thanking God for them. And I looked at him, I said, no, that was all me, you know? So like, but I really had trouble dealing with it. And most of it was because, you know, I hadn't prayed in a long time. I wasn't working step work. I started shying away from meetings. Eventually, I stopped going to meetings. It took a long road back. I got you here. Yep. So it took a long road back, but I got a sponsor and I started working the steps. Someone had told me that, God only gives special people. And I wanted to strangle them people. It was really bad, in the beginning, like when he was younger. But now I get it. Like, today he's like, he's such a big part of my life because when I started coming back, I had trouble getting in the service because I had so many different things going on with my kids. And I said to my sponsor, I really want to do, like, I miss doing service. And he said, my God, George, you're doing service 24/7. I said, you're a caretaker. And he said, service doesn't mean just NA service. You're taking care of another human being that depends on his life for you. You know, he started having seizures. And I remember like saying to my sponsor, the first seizure was devastating. Like I had no idea. He vomited, he stopped breathing. Then he started breathing, he snoring. And I said to my sponsor, I can't do this anymore. And this is just way too hard. And he said, you know, well, you know, just make your best effort, you know. I remember about the third seizure he had, I was driving home from shopping and I saw him starting to have a seizure. I pulled over on the side of the road. I pulled him out so he didn't vomit in the car. He got done like a seizure and I go like this and he goes like that's, you know, so when he does that, I know he's back. And I put the seatbelt on and I went about like my day and I said, oh, to my wife, I said, oh, by the way, he had another seizure. We hadn't had the meds right yet. And, you know, and then I said to my sponsor, like, my God, I'm like a few months ago, I thought like I would never be able to deal with this. And today it's, he says, well, you know, it's becoming part of how you live today. And that's what we learn how to do. You know, so here's, you know, took me a year to feel comfortable back in meetings again. I've been almost back now for 10 years and I'm active. I have been area chair for a couple of years. I've involved in a convention. I've traveled quite a bit and he goes with me a lot of times. Actually, I went to see Francis out in California and you know, he went out there with me. Because of that, I'm very diligent on my program today and what I do, and I've done this today, I read the, I'm on step nine now. I read the basic text, step nine. I read it in the It Works How and Why. I read the Just for Today meditation. I do a 10-step using the Living the Program pamphlet and I pray. And a lot of my prayer is thanking God for all the people in my life. I thank them for some of the material things, like, but that's like the last on the list. To me, it's people who, you know, or that I know that are getting help with their illnesses, they're getting better, you know, for my friends in my life. And then I heard at a meeting a few years ago, somebody said that they thank God for the people that aren't here anymore that helped them be who they are. And that moved me in such a way because there are so many people, all my sponsors, except for my current sponsor, are dead. You know, but there's so many people that have helped me along this path to become the person that I am today that aren't here anymore. And so by thanking God for them being in my life, that, you know, keeps them alive inside of me, you know, and, you know, I try and practice these principles in all my, you know, affairs. But I do that regimen because I don't want to go back to living the way, like I've lived working the program, living it. And I've worked like, you know, and believe me, like there's just so much joy in life. There is. I can find unhappiness or happiness in just about anything. I'll share. My wife one time made me, this is when I wasn't working the steps. My wife made me a coffee and set it down there. She said, I made you coffee, hon. And I looked at her and I said, you made it in my not favorite cup. You did that to piss me off, didn't you? And she looked at me. She goes, oh my God, are you serious? She goes, I made you a cup of coffee because I love you. I go, but you didn't put it in my favorite cup. You know, and she said, there's something wrong with you. And then I told her that the Nile wasn't just a river in Egypt. And she just, you know, she walked and, but that's how I was listening to my disease was telling me that her making me a cup of coffee was an insult and that there was something wrong. Like, you know, so like today it's about perspective. It's about looking, you know, being grateful for, you know, another day clean. I am so grateful every day that I get up and I have it. I don't know how many days I got left. I hope I got a whole bunch of them. But you know, I just moved to Florida a week ago. You know, I know so many people down here already. Mark happens to be one of them. I'm in Fort Lauderdale, but you know, and I hope to be able to get to visit my friend Francis sometime again, you know, up in Chico, you know, but you know, it's so awesome. And I'll end with this, with COVID happening in Zoom, it kind of feels like to me, like the whole process of when we were getting started all over again, there's just so many people that are being involved and doing new things and new technology. And And I have a friend of mine that says 20 years from now, you know, you'll be saying, remember when COVID hit and NA changed it, you know, like I think we're going through one of them periods now that we went through in my early recovery. That's all I got. Thanks for letting me share, guys.
Love you, George.
Thank you, George. Thank you so much, George. Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you. George.
Hello.
That was awesome.
Thank you, man.
Hello.
Thank you
so much, George.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, George.
Love you.